Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a sketch comedian from the 90s plays a new character, himself.
And how to beat the heat in your garden.
But first, President Trump has authorized a 90-day pause in the tariffs that went into effect this week, although that does not include those on China. Stock markets had reacted negatively to the news of the generally across-the-board tariffs announced last week. They rebounded on the news of the pause, though they're down again so far today. And while many economists and elected leaders worried about how the tariffs would impact consumer prices and the economy more broadly, our next guest was not one of them. Jose Grijalva is the mayor of Douglas on the Arizona-Mexico border in the southeastern part of the state. I spoke with him earlier this week after the tariffs had been announced but before the pause and asked what he's seeing in his town as it relates to this latest round of tariffs.
We're actually not seeing a lot of panic here. We're in a two-mile radius with Mexico and Agua Prieta, Sonora, which is our sister city. We have an agreement with them to, you know, we help each other out. So, I mean, once they cross the border here, they can go right to Walmart and then we could go right into their you know, their stores and their doctors too. No, there's not much of a problem because with the tariffs, you know, if we want Mexican products, all we have to do is cross the border. We just buy tortillas and cheese and then come back. So it's not really going to affect us like it is, you know, the northern cities, you know, farther up.
So you and your residents are able to basically avoid any tariffs on goods coming into the U.S. by getting them before they come into the U.S.
Yeah.
And is this something that is reasonably easy to do in Douglas?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even, you know, just to give you an example on, and it's easy on both sides, if you kind of think about it, when we had COVID and they had to shut down the border, we thought that we were going to lose the Mexican sales tax, you know, the people who come in and buy, they're 70% of our sales tax is Mexico. So they would have one person, you know, cross and take a shopping list and take it back. And that's kind of what we do on the other side, too. You know, somebody needs tortillas or cheese or, you know, the Mexican products, even like the Mexican sodas in the glass bottles. Though, you know, if they can cross, they'll cross. But if not, then they can find somebody else to cross it for them. So it's not really not a big deal. We're very close. It's walking distance from the border on both sides.
Is there a concern that with these new tariffs that fewer Mexicans will come into Douglas to shop in the stores in your town?
No, mainly because when Mexico comes over here, they just buy the American goods. So, you know, we call them changarritos, the little stores, you know, the mom and pop stores where they sell, you know, sort of grocery, a little bit of groceries and a little bit of other stuff. They'll come and buy our goods and then go and then sell them over there for maybe even double the price because they don't have an FDA over there. So they really they like our products. They like the American products and they buy them over here, take them back and then make a profit out of them. So, I mean, it benefits us because we keep the sales tax.
What are you seeing in terms of the ease with which people can cross the border and any of the have you seen any impacts from, you know, from the Trump administration's focus on cracking down on border security and illegal immigration, things like that?
That's a great question. So I was sworn in December 11th and then the next month. A few hours before he was sworn in, I asked our legal, hey, you got to look at all those executive orders just to see how they're going to affect us legally. They don't affect us legally. You know, it affects the cartels. It affects the illegal crossings. But then my biggest concern was the perception, especially with the media. So we signed a declaration of emergency. Basically, we're not going against the federal government, but we're asking the Trump administration, hey, you know, if people stop crossing from Mexico to buy our goods, can you help us out with federal money? That's basically is we're kind of anticipating a drop. But actually just passing that declaration of emergency and then sending the letter, the president a letter, we've got no blowback. We actually have a great relationship with the federal government and a great relationship with Mexico because of it, because they took it well of us thinking about them and their citizens crossing. So right now with that declaration, we're in a good place with everybody. So we haven't seen a drop like other cities have.
So you've not seen fewer people, you know, on the streets of Douglas, you know, shopping in the stores in Douglas?
No, There's this sort of anxiety that it might happen, but I mean, people feel safe here. We're a town of 16,000. Our pit is, I think, close to 150,000. So we really rely on them. But at the same time, we all know each other here, and we all know the people that cross. The only thing that separates us is the border. It's the same people, same culture. So our pit, the residents feel comfortable crossing here. So I think that's what's helped us out, too, that we have a special relationship with them.
Did you actually hear back from the federal government after you sent that letter?
No, but I kid around with people that I haven't came out on a tweet, so I think we're good.
Flying under the radar a little bit, I guess.
So yeah.
Do you think that there's a chance that other people from other parts of Arizona might come to Douglas to do what Douglas residents are doing in terms of walking across the border, buying what they need and coming back? Like, do you think there might be an influx of people from other parts of Arizona coming to do that?
Yeah, and we hope so. I mean, because if it helps out Wapita and it helps out Douglas, it helps out the other cities. So we hope so. We've also been talking about at least, you know, spreading medical tourism, because a lot of the services, the medical services in Mexico are cheaper. Not really vouching for them, but just saying, hey, they offer that over there. So, you know, if they want to come in and stay in Douglas and then, you know, buy Mexican products, we're all for that. You know, we still keep the sales tax if they stay here overnight. We have a really safe community here. We respect our law enforcement. But, you know, if they want to spend time in Mexico and go buy their products, all the better.
It sounds like these tariffs might provide somewhat of an opportunity, an economic opportunity for your town.
Yeah. And actually, because of sort of the uncertainty of both federal governments, because, you know, when I met with Agua Prieta, it was 4 years that we really didn't have a relationship with them, a consistent one. So I had their government officials come down here, and I basically told them, listen, yeah, Washington and Mexico City kind of forget about us. We're like the, you know, they're fighting right now. We're kind of like the two children in between the fight. Let's take care of each other. And I'm trying to really capitalize on that, capitalize on trade. We're going to have a new port of entry that's going to be built. We're going to be breaking ground in August for that. So we're going to need trade. So I'm actually this month, I'm going to be inviting a few Mexican cities like Hermosillo, Nacozari, Guaymas, and a few others to come and sign sister city agreements to push that trade, so we can tell both federal governments, hey, we're working with each other. We're making this relationship work.
All right. That is Mayor Jose Grijalva, the mayor of Douglas, Arizona. Mayor Grijalva, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
For months now, there has been a tense debate unfolding in Scottsdale surrounding the construction of a new headquarters for Axon, the maker of tasers and police body cameras. Axon has been based in Scottsdale for some 30 years, but they are hoping to drastically expand their footprint, building a 1.8 million square foot headquarters, along with thousands of apartments, a hotel, and retail space. The proposal has caused a tremendous amount of controversy in Scottsdale. We talked about it here on the show back in November, shortly after the city council there had granted approval for the project, and again this past January, when Scottsdale Mayor Lisa Borowski joined us to talk about the tension between Axon and Scottsdale residents regarding the number of apartments they want to build. Now the debate about the future of the project has reached the state capitol, and KJZZ's Wayne Schutzke has been following the twists and turns of this saga. He joins us now. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
So, back in January, Axon announced they had postponed the groundbreaking of this sprawling corporate complex. What happened?
Yeah, they basically, there was a citizen referendum that sent this thing to the ballot, and that wouldn't happen until 2026, so that obviously puts a big pause on this development that they want to start building right away, because it already had city council approval. So yeah, they paused the groundbreaking. They made some threats that, hey, maybe we're going to expand our search to other states nationwide to look for another place to build if we can't find a solution to this. Ultimately, they were able to go to the legislature and work on some legislation that might be able to fast-track their project.
Okay. So Representative Tony Rivero, who is a Republican, is trying to block that ballot initiative. How would that work?
Yeah, so he basically amended an existing piece of legislation, slapped this new legislation on top, and there's a lot of nooks and crannies to this legislation, but what it would effectively do is ban certain cities between populations of 200 and 500,000, including Scottsdale, from prohibiting new international headquarters from being built with hotel apartments, that kind of thing. So it would obviously affect this project. So it would effectively neuter that referendum effort and allow this to move forward.
So one of Rivero's Republican colleagues in the legislature, Joseph Chaplick of Scottsdale, has made some allegations about the motivations behind Rivero's moves here.
Yeah, he's basically said that this is a bill specifically designed to help Axon, which he says could violate the gift clause of the Arizona Constitution, which basically says you can't make any legislation that is specifically to benefit a specific individual, corporation, that kind of thing. And Rivero said, yes, Axon did come to me with this idea, but he said they ran it by their lawyers in the legislature. And because this would affect, could affect multiple companies, you know, it doesn't say in there, this only affects this Axon project. It says, you know, any city, there's a handful, four or five of them that fall within these population guidelines, that it would affect any new international headquarters in any of those cities, so it's not specifically for Axon.
Now, Chaplick has also made some pretty intense allegations regarding Axon and its CEO, right?
He got on the floor and he compared what the lobbying effort Axon's been doing to Azscam, which, you know, listeners who can go back to the early 90s will remember, resulted in criminal convictions of seven legislators, a bunch of resignations, all that kind of stuff because of kind of insider wheeling and dealing. Now, Axon has denied all of this. There has been an intense lobbying effort, though. I've seen the Axon CEO down at the Capitol just about every day over the past several months, probably meeting with legislators and stuff, trying to marshal support for this bill.
And wasn't there some sort of, like, alleged confrontation in the lobby or something like that?
Yeah, I was actually there.
Oh, no way.
I walked into the House lobby and saw them. They were very close to each other, having a heated conversation. Couldn't overhear all of it, but essentially it sounded like Axon CEO Rick Smith was kind of saying, well, enjoy your time in the legislature, kind of like a, hey, you might not be here so long.
Oh,
Chaplick took that as a threat. At one point turned to security and asked him to keep an eye on him. It didn't seem like it went further than that. They were very close, maybe brushed up against each other at some point. I wouldn't necessarily consider what I saw to be any sort of assault or anything like that, but they were definitely tense moments there.
Okay. Well, it seems like this debate is sort of a disruption of the normal political order, right?
Yeah, so a lot of this goes back to the legislature preempting local government. So the legislature taking the power that's usually reserved for the local government and local citizens, so zoning, and making a decision on their behalf and saying, you can't do this. Typically, a lot of Republicans are in favor of this. Think things like Airbnbs, short-term vacation rentals, the legislature did that a while back, saying local governments can't regulate those, and Democrats have been roundly opposed to that, trying to get return some of that power to local government. In this case, we have a handful of Republicans, Chaplick and some of his allies, trying to say basically the same thing that Democrats were saying with short-term rentals, that this is local control. And we actually saw a few Democrats align with him on that for the same reason. They're opposed to preempting local control in any situation. Wasn't enough to help him block this bill, though.
So some strange bedfellows happening there. Just about a minute left here, Wayne. What happens next with this piece of legislation, SB 1543?
So it passed a preliminary vote in the Arizona House yesterday, and so now it has to pass a full vote of the House. And based on what we saw yesterday, some of Chaplick's amendments that got blocked, it looks like it will pass that vote. Then it has to go back to the Arizona Senate for a final approval, and then it would go to Governor Katie Hobbs. So still a lot of steps in the way before this theoretically becomes law, because it's with some Democrats and the preemption issue on the table, it's unclear if Hobbs would even sign it.
Well, probably some more twists in the narrative to come. That is KJZZ's Wayne Shutsky joining us this morning. Thanks, Wayne.
Yeah, thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a comedic persona takes on a life of its own.
But first, how happy are we? There are lots of ways to measure that, although it's not always a simple question to answer. And the idea of happiness and what makes us happy can also vary a lot from person to person. The World Happiness Index aims to get a sense of it using metrics including healthy life expectancy, generosity, and positive and negative emotions. The most recent report, which takes in data averaged between 2022 and 2024, finds Finland as the happiest country on Earth. The U.S. is ranked 24th. That's the lowest we've ever ranked in the report's more than decade-long history. So clearly, there's a lot to talk about when it comes to happiness.
Happy, baby.
I'm so happy.
Happy!
Happy.
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 Do you ever wish that you could just be happier?
I didn't really believe in happiness. I thought that only idiots were happy.
Happiness is not something you find outside of yourself, and it's not something you have or don't have.
I hope you're happy. I hope you're happy now.
Your happiness is enjoyment, satisfaction, and purpose.
This week, we've been looking at the issue of happiness and how we impact it. And we started by talking about a first-of-its-kind legislative committee to study happiness as a public policy issue. It identified some conditions policymakers could try to create that would lead to their constituents' happiness. And while our final guest in the series says our own happiness is largely in our own hands, she also believes government can play a role. Sarah J. Tracy is director and professor in the Hugh Downs School of Human Communication at ASU. When I spoke with her, I asked how she defines happiness or well-being.
Yeah, so happiness, we typically think of it in a scientific way as three different levels. And one of them is what lay people think of as happiness, you know, the ebullience, the big smile, whipped cream, a massage, all those things that feel good. So that's one aspect. But there's also this aspect of flow activity where we are in a space where we forget about time. And if we look at the research of Csikszentmihalyi, he studied people who were really expert at things, whether it was chess or soccer or cooking. And when they were doing this highly expert activity, and they would lose themselves.
Sort of in the zone kind of thing.
Exactly. Yes. And you forget about eating lunch. You forget about taking a nap. And that is a space of bliss, even if your face doesn't look like you have a big smile on your face, such as like if you're in the middle of a chess game, you might look like you're really in consternation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So those are two of them. And then a third part of it is a sense of meaningfulness or a sense of purpose, feeling like when you get home at night, you have done something meaningful at work or, you know, and this meaningfulness could come through community activities, through child rearing, through, you know, taking care of community members that need it.
It seems like some of those might be more outwardly obvious than others. I mean, you mentioned, you know, you might not have a smile on your face if you're really concentrating on something that you're doing, even though it might make you happy to do it. And some of them might be like you feel happy, but it's not like a happy, happy, joy, joy kind of thing. You're like not jumping around, you know, for joy, but like you feel a sense, you know, as you referenced, that sort of sense of a job well done or a meaningful job well done, where it's not like I'm ecstatic right now, but you just sort of feel good about it.
Yeah, and the way that we actually speak about happiness in social science is subjective well-being. And that, I think, encompasses the idea that it's, you know, not what we think of as just a happy look on your face all of the time.
So what, in your mind, is the role of government in producing or increasing happiness?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, if we think about like Maslow's hierarchy, we're not even going to be thinking about, or citizens are not going to be thinking about subjective well-being unless they are physically taken care of and that they are safe. You know, these are things that, you know, can't even be a concern until those are accomplished. But connection with other people, the people who are happiest in the world have strong social networks. Mm. And thinking about ways that government could create strong social networks are public spaces, the creation of third spaces outside of home and work where people can connect in meaningful ways, you know, that we might think about green spaces, parks, et cetera. And a big happiness detractor is the small but persistent bothers in life. So if you think about the left turn light that never is long enough,
yeah,
that is something, it builds up over time. And if you can think about ways that government might be able to help get rid of some of those really bothersome, they seem small, but they add up.
So on that first point, it seems like maybe a government setting aside money to build a park or a library or something like that might increase residents' happiness, even though they're not going to be like, woohoo, like this is great. It will sort of inside make them happier. And then perhaps if they set aside money to widen a road or maybe build a sidewalk or widen a sidewalk, things like that to sort of deal with those sort of persistent sort of annoyances.
Correct. Yeah, exactly.
How does it work, though? Because, like, let's say you're somebody who doesn't like to go to parks or go to libraries or you don't drive or you don't care if it takes you a little bit longer to turn left, you know, when you're trying to get somewhere. It seems like while that would make some people happy, it might not have any kind of impact for others.
Exactly. You know, the kind of things that create happiness and upset in people can be very particular. And so thinking about different audiences and what is going to provide them that is important. I think also I would say, you know, one of the big things that people think about when they think government and happiness or well-being is money and taxes and support. And most of the research suggests that after, as you know, someone is making in America, $80,000-$90,000 a year, their happiness actually goes, it stays constant or actually can go down because of the stress. But the big wide gaps in wealth, that causes problems. And we know that one of the biggest happiness killers is social comparison. And so anything that can create space where people are less likely to be comparing themselves to one another or really have reason to negatively compare themselves with other people in terms of wealth disparity may make a difference.
I want to ask you about the concept of policies that make some people extremely happy, but at the same time make other people extremely unhappy. And you can pick any number from the federal government, from the state government, probably from city or county governments as well. I'm wondering where you see those falling as well, where, you know, somebody, if they run on a platform or even if they don't, they say, okay, we're going to do this. And some people just love it and other people really hate it.
Mm-hmm. I think you're pointing to a difference between subjective well-being and what creates happiness in the world and something that creates almost a sense of tribalism and identity politics, where it's like, it's I am right, I am the good, I am the moral. And although we could talk for ages on that,
yeah.
I think there is a bit of a difference between really thinking about how we can legislate happiness versus examining how certain politicians' actions or laws create division in the world.
Was there a difference, I wonder, between policies that maybe make you happy because you just think it's a good idea and it doesn't have any appreciable impact on your life, mm-hmm. versus policies like the kind we were talking about earlier where, you know, they're going to build a park. Great. I love going to parks. That's mm-hmm. going to make me happy to be able to sit outside and meet with friends and, you know, and play ball, you know, yeah. with friends or something like that.
Yeah. Well, the science would suggest that a burst of self-righteousness gives us a little spark of power, but it doesn't last all that long. So let's say I get on social media and I see something that makes me feel like I'm on the right team. Or that, of course, yeah, I'm smarter than everyone else. That might help me feel good for a moment, but it does not last. And so that is different than legislating for real things like creating togetherness, discouraging so much disparity in income and so on that are going to create well-being on a larger scale.
So that sounds like it's kind of the difference between maybe like fleeting happiness and actual like well-being that leads to happiness.
Yeah, yeah. Self-righteousness is not happiness.
All right. That is Sarah J. Tracy, director and professor in the Hugh Downs School of Human Communication at ASU. Sarah, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Even though it's starting to feel like summer outside, it is actually still spring. We could, though, see triple-digit high temperatures as early as today or tomorrow. That is probably not welcome news to many gardeners who worry about their plants' health in that kind of heat. With me now to talk about how to handle the heat in the garden is Melissa Cruz Peoples, who manages the Garden Commons at ASU's Polytechnic campus. She also owns a company called The Desert Smells Like Veggies. Melissa, good morning.
Good morning.
So how are you feeling about triple digits today or tomorrow?
Yikes. I know. Well, we always know it gets hot, but usually we don't have 100 degrees until May. So
right.
It is a little early. Things are looking better next week, but, you know, this is kind of our new normal. Right?
Well, so for people who maybe planted, you know, let's say sometime mid to late winter, thinking they would have until mm-hmm. May potentially before it got super hot. Like, what do they do?
Well, there's lots we can do. It's starting spring planting for us in Phoenix is actually starts back in February. So hopefully everyone's got those spring plants in and they should produce it through May and early June. And so what we can do now is put some shade cloth out using a 40-50% shade coverage. Or hopefully you've designed your garden that maybe you have some trees or things that can provide some afternoon shade to just kind of cut that heat and create a microclimate to cool it off. So those crops keep keep producing.
Even though it's triple digit temperatures.
Right. And then we need to check our irrigation and stuff too to make sure we're bumping up the water when it's a little hotter and ensure that it's functioning properly and that things are staying hydrated.
So those plants, in theory, should be producing for, you know, another maybe month, 6 weeks or so.
Yeah, like the tomatoes and eggplants and peppers. And I just got my first zucchini yesterday.
Okay.
Those should, if we planted those around by March 1st, should be producing through May. And maybe we can carry those even into the late summer as well. But there's still lots of new stuff we can plant now as well.
Yeah. So, like, what do we do? Like, obviously, we all know, as you said, the summer is going to be just wicked hot. It's going to be unpleasant to be outside. But there are certainly types of plants and flowers and fruits and vegetables that can do well in that temperature, right?
Yeah. And so I love to embrace the heat and go for the things that love the heat. That would be melons like cantaloupe or honeydew, watermelons, okra is a big one. I don't know if you've heard of Armenian cucumbers, Mark.
No, I've heard of Persian cucumbers. Are they similar?
No. So Persian cucumbers are a true cucumber, and they don't love Phoenix
yes.
heat. So Armenian cucumbers are actually technically a melon.
Oh.
And so they love the heat. We call them a cucumber because that's how they taste, and that's how we eat them, kind of immature at the seeds. They will thrive in our Phoenix climate.
Okay.
And there's lots of flowers, sunflowers and zinnias, and there's a beautiful one called Lysianthus that you can plant now. And it's sort of shocking how well some of these things do with 105, 110 degrees in full sun as well. So,
have you had to adjust how you sort of plot out your garden? I mean, the last few summers have progressively been getting a little warmer. Has that caused you to change anything?
It has caused me to maybe invest a little more in the melons and watermelons and some of these things that I know will do just fine. And I kind of really try to push that early spring planting in mid to late February to get stuff in earlier so that we can survive. Because June is our worst month almost. Because hopefully July and August, it's hot, but hopefully we also get some monsoon activity.
Yeah, what are you seeing as far as that goes?
Yeah, so NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration came out with their summer predictions. And so good news is there's a slight chance of above normal monsoon.
Slight chance. Okay.
So bad news is there's an even little tiny slighter chance it's going to be below normal. So it's kind of a wait and see approach on what actually happens. And again, our normal monsoon is only 2.7 inches of rain. So we're not talking about a lot. But hopefully it brings in some cloud cover and some just cooler and humidity and things that'll make stuff better. And so I always have a wait and see approach in July to see, okay, July can be our second spring where we can do a lot more tomatoes and squash and things that aren't like loving 110 degrees, but need some warm temperature.
I think you might get some pushback from humans saying July is the second spring.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's still hot, but we are past the summer solstice. The days are getting shorter.
Yeah.
And then we'll see what that monsoon relief is. If the monsoon seems non-existent, then I just sort of put my sights on fall, which is late September, kind of do more of the winter crops.
You just kind of give up for the rest of the summer?
Sometimes. I mean, it's kind of like desert vegetation. When things are good, we go for it and put on lots of new growth. When things are dry, we kind of hone in and just sort of focus on what we can keep alive. But it's always important to make sure we don't totally abandon the garden because the soil is alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can do things like our native tepary beans or cowpeas or things that do love the heat. And they'll just cover the soil, keep some moisture going so that soil stays alive. So when we're ready to really kind of go with lots more diversity, it's there for us.
In terms of humidity and cloud cover, like what does that do? I mean, we obviously know what it does for us as people.
Yeah.
What does it do for the plants?
Yeah, it allows them to kind of relax. When it's over 100 degrees and sunny, a lot of plants kind of close their pores, close their cells, and they put on no growth. So they're essentially alive but dormant.
Mm.
It's sort of a reverse kind of winter situation.
Like a hibernation kind
of
thing.
Yeah, kind of
almost.
Hibernation. So they're not really thriving or growing or putting new growth on or putting new flowers to make new fruits. And so when those clouds come and all that humidity in late afternoon, evening, it allows plants to kind of open up and put on more growth. And so.
So you are, as we talked about, could be hitting triple digits. Mm-hmm. I assume that means that you are adjusting water in advance of that as well?
Yeah. So I think irrigation is a great tool to use. And we don't want to be out there with the hose watering when it's that hot, but your plants, that's when they need it. And so I think now is a great time to invest in irrigation and check if you have it, check that everything's functioning and not clogged and like any parts that need replaced. And then I bump up a few minutes when it's predicted to be 100 or 100 plus. And luckily, you know, there's a lot of smart timers and smart irrigation things out there that can tie into the weather. And so they can do that automatically for you. So it's easy. And now a lot of timers you can control from your phone as well. And that sort of ensures the plants don't ever get too stressed or too behind. Because, you know, we want to go on vacation sometimes too. And so when we do that, the plants can kind of get a little sickly or too behind. And so it's hard to recover and produce.
All right, fair enough. I'll have to leave it there. That is Melissa Cruz Peoples, who manages the Garden Commons at ASU's Polytechnic campus. Melissa, thanks for coming in as always.
Thanks, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Growing up in Tucson, Natalie Cook used to dress up like a cowgirl, go to rodeos, and take trips to Tombstone, site of the infamous shootout at the OK Corral. Like a lot of kids, she was fascinated by Old West culture, or at least the version of it that American movies often portray. These days, Cook is a professor at Syracuse University, where she specializes in political geography. Among other things, she studies the ways that spatial relationships interact with political relationships. And in an article for a publication called The Anti-Atlas, Cook wrote about Western movies, but not the American ones. Germany, it turns out, also has a significant cinematic tradition of stories set in the Old West. And as Cook told me recently, they expand the scope of the genre in fascinating ways.
My family heritage is German, primarily German, but I hadn't actually spent a lot of time there when I was young. And so I started to go to Germany quite a bit later when I was in graduate school. And that's when I started to watch these German films that were called Westerns, but they were not filmed in the U.S. West, but filmed in Yugoslavia. And a lot of the ideas were similar to what I had encountered when I was growing up, but they were also very different. Like the landscapes were different, the ideas and the way that they spoke and constructed the Wild West was rather jarring for me to encounter.
Yeah. What were the stories that were being told in these versions of the Wild West?
The first sort of Wild West stories came out not necessarily in film, but in the books of Carl May, who he's kind of known to be the most selling author in German. And his stories about the Wild West were attached to this one character whose name was Winnetou. And his first book about Winnetou was published in 1875. So this was like going way, way back.
Wow.
Yeah. And the Winnetou stories were not made into films until 1962. And that was when the first German Western film came out. It was called Treasure of Silver Lake.
This map shows the way to a treasure beyond price. And this man murdered to possess it. Now nothing could stop him leading his outlaw army to steal the treasure of Silver Lake.
This really like shocked the film company when they released it. They did not expect it to be such a success, but it turned into just this huge blockbuster and then sort of catapulted these Wild West films into this whole series that became quite beloved in Germany in the 1960s.
Wow. So, I mean, this is always a very interesting thing, right? When one country takes the mythology or the lore of another country and presents their take on it, oftentimes, no matter how quote unquote accurate they're trying to be, this very different perspective ends up imbuing the storytelling, right?
Carl May had never been to the United States. Like, he didn't know anything about the West. Like, he really made up a lot of the stuff. And that's more or less what happened in the films as well. But one thing that became really interesting as I started to look into this history of these films is that the films that I'm talking about right now, like the Winnetou stories from the 1960s, this was just the West German version. So at this time in the 1960s, Germany was, of course, divided between East and West. And it wasn't until 1966 that East Germany released their first Western film. And the storyline in the East German films was a really strong critique of like Western imperialism following the sort of anti-capitalist account of the Soviet and communist agenda. And so in this, you could see how they talked about the evils of American settler colonialism and capitalism in that particular storyline, which of course was quite different in the West German ones.
That's fascinating to imagine. Can you give us an example of what that looked like in one of the films?
Yeah, so, well, it might help just to compare two different films. So The West German film, like the first one that came out in The Treasure of Silver Lake, or even the second one, Apache Gold, in these films, there's two main characters, the white guy who comes and is like settling the U.S. Southwest, and the Native American figure who's supposed to be Apache. They work together, and they like the white settler sort of helps and becomes friends with Winnetou. They become blood brothers, et cetera, et cetera. So there's kind of this story of companionship and cooperation. In the East German films, by contrast, there's none of that. It is all about antagonism. The white settlers are evil. They are coming to steal the Native American land. And there's really only this kind of antagonism. And even when there are the white settlers portrayed in these films, they play a rather limited role. So it's much more the sort of communist storyline of lifting up the people who are oppressed in this particular situation. And then the Native Americans become the heroes in the East German films.
That is fascinating. It's very interesting to me that East German filmmakers at that time would choose stories from the American West to advance these sorts of themes in a story. Was there any sense that they were doing that because a film that tried to tell a similar story with East German characters rather than American characters wouldn't have been allowed or wouldn't have been as well received?
I think it was simply that across the communist world, they had become really enchanted by Western films. Uh-huh. And the main reason that some people point to for this is that in 1960, The Magnificent Seven, that film was allowed into the Soviet Union. And it became this instant sensation. People in the Soviet Union became obsessed with Westerns. And this kind of spread into the communist countries and to the East as well. And Westerns had just shown themselves to be incredibly popular. And so the Soviet critique was that it was just capitalist propaganda. They wanted to say, okay, well, if the genre is really popular, then how can we do it with our ideological message? And that's when the Soviets started to make some of their own Westerns, and then the East Germans, they took this up, as I said, in 1966 with their first Western, The Sons of Great Bear.
As you learned more about this, how did it affect your recollections of, you know, your youthful cowgirl cosplay back in Tucson, and also your thoughts about the way that we tell those kind of Old West stories here in the U.S.?
I have to say my immediate reaction to watching the first German films was like, this is ridiculous. This looks totally fake. But as the more I reflected on it, I realized that sort of theater of what I was critiquing in the German films is actually something that I was part of when I was growing up in the U.S. Southwest. So there's this kind of fantasy and positive story that gets attached to the Wild West narratives in Arizona today that is, well, it erases a lot of violence and it erases a lot of the critiques that the East German films were making about U.S. imperial expansion into the U.S. Southwest. And so reflecting on the falseness of those German films made me realize that I actually had just been fully imbibing that Western lore that romanticized that past within my upbringing in the U.S. Southwest.
Natalie Cook is a professor at Syracuse University. Her piece in the Anti-Atlas is called When Yugoslavia Was the Wild West.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Mark, do you remember the sketch comedy group Kids in the Hall?
Yeah, of course. They were a Canadian group, right?
Yes. They were sort of like a offbeat, kind of surrealist cousin of SNL. Incidentally, they were also produced by Lorne Michaels. And they had this cult classic TV show on Comedy Central back in the 90s. Their sketches were often very conceptual, but in addition to the sketches, sometimes they would do bits where it was just a character giving a monologue. And one of those characters was Buddy Cole, the owner of a gay bar, who would sometimes show up and do these monologues about his life.
Ever since I quit smoking, I've had a renewed interest in athletics. Well, athletes. That's why when my friend Opal asked me if I would manage her lesbian softball team, I said yes. But I made it completely clear to Opal and the rest of the girls that when I say manage, I mean the whole ball of wax. That means pitching, catching, running, hair, wardrobe, attitude.
Buddy Cole was played by Kids in the Hall cast member Scott Thompson. Kids in the Hall went off the air decades ago, but Thompson has kept Buddy Cole alive in various forms over the years, and he's currently touring a solo show called Buddy Cole in the Last Glory Hole. I spoke with Thompson recently, and at the beginning of the conversation, right as I started recording, Scott was having trouble connecting to the virtual recording software that we sometimes use to talk to guests remotely. Now, that is obviously something I would usually cut out of my edit for one of these segments, but in this case, I left it in for reasons that will become clear.
I just can't find the right thing to plug it in. It's like I got a million of them, but none of them work.
Yeah.
I hate this. I hate this world that we live in. It's bullshit that comedians and actors have to be technicians now. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here with a million cords, two headphones, a laptop, an iPad, a phone, and I can hear you. You might as well be in a tin can and a shoestring.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. It's just really frustrating.
No, I understand. We could try this.
I can't be the only person that's like this. I can't imagine we live in a world where comedians and writers and actors are actually also very good with tech. It doesn't make any sense.
Right. Well, let me try this. If you don't mind, Scott, could I try calling you on your phone? I might be able to do it that way.
Yeah, you can do that. Yes.
All right. Stand by. I'm going to try that.
Okay. It's really maddening. Maddening. This is maddening. Maddening.
Hello?
Hello, yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well,
I just want nothing to do with the digital world. I really don't. I can't believe how much it bothers me. I don't really understand what we've done to ourselves.
Well, and increasingly,
I just sound like a cranky old Luddite. I know.
That's all right. I mean, it is interesting, though, when it comes to the idea of, you know, being an independent creator like yourself, because tell me if you disagree, but it seems in order to be a creative, you have to choose some sort of platform that forces you to be writer, director, producer, editor, all of these things. And increasingly, in choosing one of those platforms, you're also making a bit of a political statement.
No, I don't agree. No.
Okay.
No, I don't agree. I don't think about, should I go on this road because someone owns the road that I don't agree with? I still use the road.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I just think the world's gotten so politicized. My God, I don't know. Like, not everything has to be political.
Well, do you think of, I mean, this show that you're doing, Buddy Cole in the Last Glory Hole, do you think of that show as having a political core to it?
Well, I don't know what you mean by politics. I talk about, most of my work is about human behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think of human behavior as being left or right or aligned with any kind of philosophy. I just think of it as being human. And I've always used Buddy Cole to say things that I might not be comfortable saying, but that's what this show is about. Basically, I do most of the show as him. And then about three quarters of the way through the show, Buddy starts to realize that he might not be real, that he might be a character.
Yeah.
And then he starts to realize that there's somebody behind him. There's somebody that it's me.
Right.
And I want out. I don't need you any longer. I don't have to hide behind this character the way I have for almost my entire career.
Yeah.
You could not be an openly gay stand-up when I started.
So that's really interesting.
I mean,
because
I
think of you as such a gifted character comedian. And like a lot of people, I discovered your work first through Kids in the Hall. And I loved your character work on that show. But if I'm hearing you right, that's a skill that you had to develop, because doing stand-up in a less characterful way didn't feel like a pathway that was available.
Well, that's true. And I started, when I first began my career, I wanted to be just a regular actor. And I thought, well, I could be funny, but I can't be a comedian, because a comedian has to be honest about who you are and the way where I came from. That was not possible. So I had to create Buddy Cole, because that character of an effeminate gay male, people go, that person is not serious. So in many ways, it allowed me to say very dangerous things, very subversive things.
Right.
Like a clown. It was my clown, really.
Yeah. How close is the truth that Buddy Cole tells? I mean, Buddy Cole, as you said, he's this very big, extreme character. He's like this lounge lizard guy.
Yeah.
How much do you feel like the types of things that he wants to joke about, whether they're sexual or political or whatever else, how much are his opinions and his takes, how similar are they to Scott Thompson's?
Very.
Okay.
Very
got it.
Yeah, because the thing is, with the difference between him and I is that I, up until very recently, a lot of the things that I wanted to talk about, I had a hard time separating anger from it. And comedy doesn't work if the audience senses the anger that powers it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So often anger is like it's the fuel and the engine, but the audience should never smell the gasoline. But with Buddy Cole, you just smell cotton candy. You don't smell anger. You don't smell... I mean, most stand-ups do have a persona.
Sure,
but
sure.
The ones that I love were people that had a character. Like my favorite comedian of all time is Barry Humphries, who played Dame Edna.
Uh-huh.
These are characters that people use to express certain things that they could not.
Well, that's the thing that's interesting to me, Scott, is it strikes me as we're talking about this, you know, as you pointed out, personas are something comedians have toyed with for a long time. And I'm even thinking, as we're talking about Andy Kaufman and Tony Clifton, you know, where they're...
Yes, absolutely. Yes. They're another big influence for me. Yeah.
But but even with Andy and Tony...
Or Sacha Baron Cohen, another one, too, with his characters.
Absolutely.
He's another, a person that's really influenced me.
But something that I think is interesting about those guys is the fact that, say, Sacha Baron Cohen and, say, Borat are the same person is implicit. It's not explicit. And in the case of Andy and Tony, there are people to this day who argue about which one was the real guy. What you're doing is something really kind of subversive, not just in terms of the subject matter you're talking about, but comedically in this tradition, you're openly acknowledging that this is a line that at a certain point can be erased, and that one character can kind of dissolve into the truth of the person behind the character.
Yes, because so much of Buddy was basically me owning all the things that I was ashamed about.
Yeah.
And for many years, people have said, Scott, you can't be yourself. No one can handle you. You're too much. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, I don't think so. I think I can do it. I think I'm in much more control.
I just wanted to say thank you for taking the time to have this conversation. And I appreciate you dealing with the technical difficulties at the beginning. And I'm so struck by the fact that, you know, we've been having this conversation about the obstacles that you have faced in just communicating with your voice. And here we had this very tangible experience of that to start the conversation.
Yeah, you're right. It's like if it isn't like Puritans, it's technology.
Yeah.
Something always gets in my way.
Well, Scott Thompson will be performing his show Buddy Cole in the Last Glory Hole at the Mesa Arts Center on April 10th. Scott, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.